Hello, I'm Barbara Tobias, and this is City Beat. This is the September 18 through 24 edition, and the cover story, Youth, Trauma, Trials, Time. Hamilton County's juvenile justice system has been in the background of some of this summer's most intense news. A close look at the system reveals big disparities, but also efforts to change outcomes. This article is by Nick Swartzell. The late afternoon sun is streaming into the windows of the Clifton Mosque's lobby by the time Abdul Kabir Muhammad walks in, a coral shirt to match the sunset stretched across broad shoulders, a big smile pulling his black beard upward. Muhammad's shirt is flecked with grass from the mowing he's been doing that day, and most days, all day, for the last couple years. The 35-year-old started his own landscaping business that now takes him across the city and into Tony suburbs like Indian Hill as a way to support his three children after he spent more than 9 years in a state prison in Madison County. Muhammad is very open about his past, but isn't here to talk about that particular incident necessarily. He's here to talk about a time before that, before he went to prison and discovered Islam and a sense of stability, before the whirlwind of adult court appearances, a time when he was still a kid with a single mom, trying to navigate the quickly draining environs of Cincinnati's near west side, when the trouble started. I can look back and see and admit that a lot of what I was doing was reactionary, he says. At the time, I didn't want to see it that way. I was still in a war mode. When you're young and you experience and witness violence from the first, it makes you a certain way. My home wasn't bad. My mom was on top of everything. But my environment outside of that, Westwood, Price Hill, those areas, you had things like someone throwing a rock and hitting you in the head and taking your book bag. Those kinds of things affect you. Muhammad's experience isn't unique. Hamilton County's lower income neighborhoods and schools like the ones he grew up in, many of them predominantly black, thanks to decades of government policies and market forces that wrought intense economic segregation, feed a highly disproportionate number of African-American youth in the county's juvenile justice system. That system has been in the background of local conversations about crime, justice, and race lately. In the midst of a sweltering summer during which gun violence claimed the lives of multiple minors as young as 14, the saga of Democratic former Hamilton County Juvenile Court Judge Tracy Hunter reached a furious coda when she was dragged out of a Hamilton County courtroom to serve a 6-month sentence. Hunter ran on promises to reform the county's juvenile system, and her supporters say paid a political price for trying to do so. Others, however, say Hunter fell behind on her job and didn't work with other judges and broke the law. Whether or not Hunter was treated justly, the racial disparities she campaigned on fixing are real, viewable in black and white in the form of Hamilton County juvenile court data and Cincinnati police arrest records. In a county where census data says 30.3% of people under 18 are African American, 81% of the more than 2,000 minors issued warrants through the Hamilton County juvenile court last year were black, according to data that City Beat obtained from the court, up from 75% in 2015. And 75% of the 930 young people admitted to the county's youth detention center in 2018 were black, though that's down from 80% in 2015. Those disparities also exist on the front lines of the juvenile justice system. Select streets and schools in Cincinnati, and its poorer suburbs, most predominantly black, where police make the most juvenile arrests. In Cincinnati, which is about 43% black, 85 to 90% of juveniles arrested by Cincinnati police have been black in recent years, arrest data from the city shows. Few dispute the clear overrepresentation of black youth in the county's juvenile justice system. But that's just the start of a vast, complicated conversation. Why are so many more black youth arrested in Hamilton County, either in schools or in neighborhoods? What happens to them when they enter the juvenile system? What roles do racial bias, socioeconomic factors, and the trauma that can come with growing up without resources play? Pushing against these questions are still more numbers. Police are arresting far fewer youth than they used to, part of a national trend in falling crime rates. And Hamilton County Juvenile Court is locking up or sending away far fewer of them to state juvenile detention centers, thanks in part to a series of diversion programs, court officials say. In the last 5 years, the number of youth detained in Hamilton County has dropped nearly 20%. In 1995, Hamilton County Juvenile Court sent 440 young people, most of them African Americans, to detention facilities run by Ohio's Department of Youth Services. Last year, it sent just 60. It also transferred 130 young people to the adult justice system via a process known as bindover in 1995. Last year, it bound over 33 youth. Of those, however, 30 were Black. Hamilton County Juvenile Court Judge John Williams, a Republican and former juvenile prosecutor, ran against Hunter and was later appointed and then elected judge in 2012. He acknowledges the disparities in the terms of the youth who come through his doors, but he defends the court's treatment of them. For him, it boils down to economics. The reason we're having so many more minority kids is that there's not as much opportunity in those areas where they live, Williams says. If the family is being pulled apart, if mom's working maybe two jobs or more, the young ones are left to be taking care of themselves. Now, these numbers are the vast minority of people. Criminal complaints are down by half from their peak in the 1990s. And we're also taking a different path here in the court. Even with fewer arrests, detentions, and bindovers, however, the disparities persist. Some activists say the police shouldn't be arresting kids in schools and neighborhoods at all, and that children shouldn't be subjected to courts. Others, including legal advocates, say that police and courts still need to do a better job offering community-based means by which to deal with young people. The Northern Kentucky-based Children's Law Center advocates for young people caught up in Hamilton County's juvenile justice system and other courts throughout the region. CLC reentry attorney Carrie Gilbert says the drivers of the large racial disparities in the county's juvenile justice system are complex. "I don't think it's coming from any single source," she says. "I don't think we will ever be able to just point and say, it's the police or it's the county. I think it's white supremacy that's ingrained in our systems and our institutions. I think it's very difficult for institutions to have conversations about that." The front lines. Data shows most of the roughly 1,800 juvenile arrests in Cincinnati that happened in 2016 occurred in neighborhoods like the ones Muhammad grew up in. In 2016, Westwood saw almost 150 juvenile arrests, 85% of them Black youth. The West End saw more than 160 juvenile arrests that year, all but a handful of them Black youth. College Hill saw roughly 200 juvenile arrests, more than 90% of them Black youth. Meanwhile, predominantly white, higher-income neighborhoods had far fewer arrests of young people. High Park saw fewer than 30. Mount Lookout had just a few. But the pattern isn't always clear-cut. Some lower-income, majority-Black neighborhoods like Millvale and South Cumminsville also had very few juvenile arrests, even when controlling for the size of the population there. The disparities go beyond arrests. In connection with a lawsuit last year over the tasing of an 11-year-old girl by an off-duty CBD officer at a Kroger, attorneys with Cincinnati law firm Gerhardt Steen & Branch analyzed taser use by the Cincinnati Police Department from 2013 to 2018, and they found that all but six of the 110 minors tased by the Cincinnati Police Department were Black, and that 48 of those youth were under the age of 15. Not all of that legal trouble for young people starts in schools, but there are hundreds of arrests at districts like Cincinnati Public Schools every year. And data obtained via a public records request by CityBeat shows big disparities in arrests between 2011 and 2015 in CPS. CityBeat has requested more recent data, but has yet to receive it from the Cincinnati Police. In 2015, 595 of the 670 arrests of minors on CPS property were of Black youth, 89%. That's well above the 63% of district students who are Black. Data for the four previous years, representing more than 3,700 arrests, when including 2015, show similar disparities. Not surprisingly, these arrests tend to happen in the district's larger high schools, but not all of them. Western Hills High School in Westwood, which has a student body of just over 1,000, saw more than 1,000 arrests between 2011 and 2015, according to the data. Aiken High School in College Hill, which has about 650 students, saw 540 arrests over those 5 years. Withrow High School, which hosts roughly 1,200 students, saw roughly 500 in that time period. All were predominantly black. Predominantly white Walnut Hills, meanwhile, CPS's flagship magnet school, with an enrollment of almost 3,000, saw roughly 20 arrests from 2011 to 2015, according to the data. Some of the arrests at CPS were for fighting, weapons possession, or other serious safety concern. Others, however, are harder to ascribe to safety. Between 2011 and 2015, 3 8-year-olds, 3 9-year-olds, 18 10-year-olds, 27 11-year-olds, and 66 12-year-olds were arrested at CPS Elementary School. Some of those incidents were also intense. For example, a 2015 fight in which 1 9-year-old was arrested for repeatedly kicking and punching another young student with a group of other students until the victim had a broken elbow and bruised spine. Others, however, were seemingly minor, sometimes stemming from events like throwing things in a school cafeteria or pranks. In one 2014 case, police reports reveal that a white school staff member called officers on an 8-year-old student for making a lewd phone call over a school telephone. That student ended up with a written citation from officers and a call home to his parents, though no further action seems to have been taken following the arrest. CPS did not respond to 2 emails seeking details about the district's policies around law enforcement. Cincinnati Police School's resource officers, however, were happy to talk about their work in CPS. SROs, or school resource officers, have been somewhat controversial in Cincinnati, with some activist groups saying they represent an inappropriate law enforcement presence in places that should be dedicated to learning. Before changing its name to Cincinnati Mass Action for Black Liberation, Cincinnati Black Lives Matter mounted a relatively popular and long-running CBD Out of CPS campaign, protesting police presence in local public schools. But Cincinnati Police School Resource Officer Eddie Hawkins says SROs work hard to build rapport with students, precisely so they can head off problems and avoid arrests. An assessment even some police accountability advocates like the Black United Front's Iris Rowley and attorney Al Gerhardstein of Gerhardstein & Branch generally agree with. Hawkins grew up in Avondale and readily admits he questioned some of the things he saw from police when he was younger. He also acknowledges there's some racial bias in policing and in the arrest disparities both in the juvenile and adult justice systems. But for Hawkins, the main drivers are a mix of readily available, sometimes violent social media, the crumbling of low-income families, and the tightly wound issues of race and poverty that sometimes come to a boiling point in some public schools and neighborhoods with lower-income youth. Add to the mix the fact that most students in those situations don't have the resources to mount a legal defense or the networks to keep an incident out of the courts the way more affluent families might, and that some officers patrolling those areas don't have much exposure to minority communities. And you've got a recipe for the kinds of disparities shown in the data, he says. I don't think anyone says racism doesn't exist, he says. Are we really willing to have the tough conversations about it? I can show you the disparities when it comes to African Americans and arrests, but let's talk about the intangibles that are happening that get those kids in trouble. Are some kids in the suburbs, doing acid, doing dope, stealing their parents' credit cards? They're up to a lot of the same things, but it's a different environment. Trauma around violence in some communities also plays a big role, Hawkins says. When you have a third or fourth grader who's losing classmates to violence, stray bullets, or they're losing their 14 or 15-year-old siblings to violent crimes, it's very traumatic, Hawkins says. I hear young people say they're not going to live to 18. That's their reality. We also have a lot of families that are experiencing homelessness, and some of these folks have jobs. The American dream sometimes gets lost in the shuffle. You're out here, you're working, and yeah, maybe you had kids younger than you should have, but you're trying to make ends meet, and it gets stressful. And then maybe you're living out of a car, and the kids see their parents are doing what they can, but they don't have the best clothes at school, and they get ragged on. All those things wear on the psyche of a young person. When you're young, your brain isn't developed enough to take on all of that. So a lot of people, a lot of young people, crack and lash out. Against that backdrop, the SROs, the role that the SROs play isn't well understood, he says. They're there to mediate conflicts and connect students with things like CPD's summer cadet program and to mental health services that schools and outside providers offer. For us, it's an opportunity to engage young people a little more in depth, he says. With your normal officer on the street, the interactions they're having with young people are generally negative because they're responding to a crime. Yes, ultimately our job is to police. If there's a criminal infraction, we'll handle it like a criminal infraction. However, we have the ability to be flexible. We can take into consideration if a young person has a lot going on. What can we do before we get to the justice system, before we take this person to jail? CPD has 14 SROs responsible for 112 public, charter, and private schools. Each SRO is based at one of CPS's high schools. From those schools, each also covers middle and elementary schools in the general geographic area, as well as covering for neighboring SROs when they're busy or off duty. It's a lot different from other departments across the county, says CPD Youth Services Unit Supervisor Cassandra Tucker. In most cities, it's two SROs in a high school, one in the middle school and one in the elementary. One SRO here could have a high school plus 12 to 14 other schools. A few CPS teachers, speaking off the record, have said they generally don't worry about SROs but express concerns about drug sweeps and locker searches by CPD at schools like Aiken. Hamilton County Public Defender Juvenile Division Director Allison Hathaway echoes those concerns and adds that she's seen video of at least two cases in which the officers and schools used force against youth that she felt was disturbing and wasn't warranted. They do go in and do random searches, she says. I know that happens, and it may happen more regularly at some schools than others. Despite those concerns, Hathaway acknowledges she's seen fewer youth coming to the court from CPS in recent years, even before the Ohio General Assembly effectively decriminalized truancy in 2017. But there's still work to be done, she says. I think Cincinnati Public Schools have been less quick to bring kids in. It's less of a problem now, but it's still happening. I feel like if it happens once, that's too many times. But I'm admittedly on the other side of the fence. School isn't the place where you should go expecting to be arrested. Now, if blood is being shed or things like that, that's different. But generally, the stuff we see, the little fights and theft, no. First signs of trouble. The links between school, neighborhood, and the justice system aren't new. Back when he was growing up around Westwood, Price Hill, and South Fairmont in the 1990s, Muhammad went by the name of his birth certificate, Ramil Williams. His neighborhood was tough. South Fairmont, where Central Fairmont School was located, had an unemployment rate of 16% in 1990. When Muhammad would have been preparing to start school there, and more than a quarter of the people in the neighborhood lived below the poverty line. His mother was single, and by the age of 9, he had experienced things that would put him in what he calls a constant state of fight or flight, including a brawl starting from a friendly game of football that at one point seemed to bring out most of the people living in his apartment complex. That year, he was kicked out of Central Fairmount after a fight with a white student who was pulling on Muhammad's sister's hair and pushing her. Muhammad stepped in, he says, leading the other student to call him the N-word. The resulting altercation left the other child with a concussion. Muhammad soon found himself in the principal's office with his mother, who argued to keep Muhammad in school as the other child's mother was calling for him to be expelled. The principal decided Muhammad should go. "In that moment, I felt like something was wrong with the world," he says, "because my mom was my world. She wasn't on drugs. I never saw her drink. I never saw her lift a cigarette to her face. She was just a single black woman who had children young and could only afford a place in the ghetto. I saw this person who was the world for me, who was my source of power, be overpowered. And I gave up on the world a little after that. I began to see that I had to find power for myself." Looking to keep him in school, Muhammad's mother shifted him to his grandmother's house, just across the city line in Coleraine. School there was easier in some ways and harder in others. While he enjoyed the calmer atmosphere, Muhammad said it was hard to adjust to a predominantly white school after having attended one that was mostly black. Behavior problems began surfacing as he struggled to fit in, and within a year, he was placed in a special education class. They didn't have a system in place to deal with that at the time, he says. They had not dealt with children who came from the inner city who had problems with violence, because we came from a violent environment. So they isolated you. It turned into, how did this kid get in here? I felt like it was confusion on top of confusion. And just to protect my sanity, I had to make myself not care about things. And that's when your behavior becomes risky. The family continued to move around, landing in Mount Healthy when Muhammad was in his teens. He wasn't the only one coming from a rough environment to the suburban community at the time. All of my friends who came out there came from the inner city, he says. Some from Winton Terrace, some from downtown, some from Bond Hill. Their moms flocked out to Mount Healthy. Certain neighborhoods have their gangs and their rivalries, and in those neighborhoods it was contained. But in Mount Healthy, all those kids who came from all those rival neighborhoods, rival streets, now were all in one neighborhood. At 14, a group mistook Muhammad for a member of a rival gang, he says, because they knew where he had moved from. They started to jump him, but a group from another gang stepped in and fought for him. That hit my heart, he says, so I started to run with them for a while. That's when everything avalanched. Muhammad had a few run-ins with the law as a fledgling gang member that didn't amount to much, but at 16, he was arrested during a large fight between rival groups at Mount Healthy High School. He was charged with assault and spent several days in 2020, the Hamilton County Youth Center, nicknamed 2020 for its address at 2020 Auburn Avenue in Mount Auburn, before he was released. The experience marked another turning point for him, he says. It was weird, he says, very weird, because it was my first time in the system. After that, it was nonstop. Going to 2020. These days, the experience might be somewhat different. Young people picked up by the police or brought by guardians enter the large, angular Hamilton County Youth Center in Mount Auburn from a lower level and take elevator 4 to the first floor, where they're booked into the facility's secure northern side. On the southern side, there are 2 courtrooms and a battery of psychological assessment units where court clinicians and others work to keep some family behavioral issues from hitting court dockets and assess young people already there for competency to stand trial in mental health issues. In many ways, the secure side of the facility is much like you'd expect from a detention, is much like you'd expect a detention facility to be. Guards in a central security kiosk monitor video feeds from across the huge facility and buzz staff and visitors through double sets of locked doors. The construction is cinder block, the interior Spartan and white. Brian Bell is the director of detention here. He wears a crisp suit, sports neatly cropped hair, and has just a hint of a twang when he speaks. On a recent tour of the facility, Bell runs through the procedure when a young person is brought in. First, a county clerk, one of several, working at cinder block cubicles here on the first floor, will review police reports and determine whether the county has probable cause to hold the young person. The youth is also asked whether they're injured, ill, under the influence, or pregnant, all conditions that could result in being taken to the hospital instead of held in the youth center. Youth are also assessed for risk of suicide. The last at the youth center was in 1985. And if they're found to be high risk, they're monitored by detention facility staff every 4 to 5 minutes via a system where guards must push a button just outside the window into a youth's cell. If the button isn't pushed within that time frame, the central security kiosk is alerted. Lower risk youth are monitored in person every 14 to 15 minutes. The probable cause determination that happens early in the intake process is important. In 2014, the Children's Law Center sued Hamilton County over allegations it was holding young people in violation of their constitutional rights to due process. The suit cited two particular cases in which juveniles were held for more than 20 days in the youth center without probable cause determinations, but CLC also sought to make the legal challenge a class action suit, citing the 2,340 youth detained at the center the prior year. The suit also cited statistics from the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention that suggested that black children in Hamilton County were almost 10 times more likely to be arrested in 2013 than white children, and more than 2 times as likely to be placed in detention. As a result of the lawsuit, the county juvenile court agreed to make significant changes in its intake processes, including new processes for warrants issued for youth, more training for clerks at the youth center, the creation of an on-duty magistrate position available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to weigh in on probable cause and other changes. The county also has a new risk assessment tool called RAI, developed last year in collaboration with youth advocates, nonprofits, the prosecutor's office, and others, to better determine when a child can be safely diverted from detention. That computerized assessment tool considers age, offense history, seriousness of the current alleged offense, whether parents or guardians are available, and whether there are diversion options open, and a number of other details. We try to divert and cite as often as possible, Bell says. 20 years ago, you'd have a high percentage of kids staying here. We had 200 kids as our everyday population. Now, based on movements to not detain low-level offenders, we have 82 people here today. County officials can choose to override the RAI, either in favor of diversion or the other way around, holding youth they believe pose too steep a risk to release. If there's probable cause to hold someone, the youth will be cited and given a plea hearing date. They're then admitted, given jumpsuits and slippers issued by the youth center, searched fully, and given the opportunity to shower. There are also a myriad health care options available at the youth center, including 2 nurses from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, available 24 hours a day, a part-time dental and mental health clinic. All youth held in the youth center also attend classes instructed by CPS teachers from 8:30 to 2:30 p.m. each day. Bell stresses that the youth center is focused on programming that can help provide therapeutic activities, 22 different offerings that range from art to yoga to gardening in an area outside the center's gym, plus a variety of other programs offered by faith-based groups. I learned how to play chess in here, youth center housing director Will Allen says of one of those programs as he stands outside an austere green and white painted pod where the kids live. One of the kids taught me. It used to be every time I came in for my shift. His name was Ron. I still remember him. We'd sit down and play. That's all the time we have today. My name's Barbara Tobias. This has been City Beat. See you next week.